before I forget it. We're doing what we've called a survey of eschatology. Remember what that word means? Well, the latter part of it just means the study of, ologies, the study of, and the esca part comes from a Greek word that means the end. So we're studying the end things, end times of biblical prophecy and that sort of thing. And so that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to look at the book of Daniel. We're going to look at the book of Revelation. We're going to talk about certain passages, certain chapters in Ezekiel, and a few other relevant prophetic passages as well. So we'll kind of touch upon a bunch of things before we're done. And we're going to see a lot of prophetic history before we're done. In your handout, there's a slide that looks like this, which is kind of a summary or an overview of the book of Daniel. And chapter 1 is kind of an intro. We'll come back to that in just a moment to talk about that a little bit. But chapters 2 through 7 then deal with a period of time that's oftentimes referred to as the times of the Gentiles or the latter days. Either way, we'll talk about that more as we go along. And then chapters 8 through 12 is a summary of the prophetic history specifically of Israel. So we get a broad brush look at all of the Gentile nations and their prophetic history, and then we'll see a fairly detailed summary of Israel's prophetic history. They will be much more of a player than we think we are. We ain't really anything, but we just think we are. But we'll just kind of see how that all works out. And you have another page that looks kind of like this. I don't think yours has the... It's a summary of the visions that we're going to see. This book is full of visions. You can see there's actually going to be six of them. Nebuchadnezzar has some. Daniel has some. So there will be a variety of those. And those visions will summarize what we just talked about before, that the prophetic history of both the Gentiles and the Jews. Those first three of them will have to do, again, with the history of the Gentile nations, and the last three will have to do with the prophetic history of Israel. So those two slides kind of overview the book for you. And we'll see some more. We'll see a bunch of other stuff as we go on through here. But last week, we started out by asking and answering the question, what the heck is Daniel doing up in Babylon? Babylon is the idolatry capital of the planet, and he's being a good Jewish boy. He should have been living down in his home country of Israel, Palestine. And so we ask, well, what in the world happened that got him up there? And the answer really has to do with a couple of different things. Can you see those light pastels? I know they're hard probably from where you're sitting to see them. But up here in this purple area right up here is the Babylonian Empire. And that's where Daniel is. He's up there. He's over here in Babylon right there. And what has happened that has gotten him up there is two main things. One is that the remaining kingdom of David, the only part that's left, two nations known as Judah, down to the south, down here. That's all that's left of David's kingdom at the time that this book opens up, Daniel. They're about to be judged by God because of their disbelief and their idolatry. And that's all that's left of the empire of David, of David's kingdom at this time. And so that region is the focus of a judgment that God is going to bring on them. And he's going to use the geopolitics of the day to bring that about. Again, here's Babylon up here. And here's Egypt down here. Those two powerhouses are vying for world domination. They're fighting one another. And as it turns out, Babylon was the victor of that conflict. There's a place up here called Carchemish. It's about right in there somewhere. And up there, the Babylonian Empire defeated the Egyptian Empire. Okay, who cares? Well, these people in between these two, they care, because these little nations right in through here, Judah and others, had to pick which side of this conflict they wanted to be on. Who were they going to ally themselves with? And Judah made the mistake of aligning themselves with the loser, Israel. So Nebuchadnezzar is coming back now, and he's sort of evening the score with these little nations right in through here, Judah and Lebanon and Jordan and, you know, those little guys right in through here. So he has come back down here now and has besieged Judah, Jerusalem, the kingdom of Judah, in about 605, 606 B.C. If you just remember around 600 years before Christ, you're in the right ballpark. But he has besieged this place, the first of three sieges, and in that first siege apparently took Daniel and some other people captive, took them back to Babylon. And through the providential oversight of Daniel's life by God, he was put in this program of government training. Outstanding program, educationally and professionally and otherwise, and was taken up to Babylon. And through that program, he became then a servant in the Babylonian government. So he's kind of within arm's reach of Nebuchadnezzar at this point in time. So that's why he's up there. His homeland has been taken captive. It hasn't completely fallen yet, but the first of three sieges. He and some other people of his homeland have been taken captive up there to Babylon. So that's why he's up there as part of God's judgment on that nation for their idolatry and general disobedience. So he's there, instead of where you would expect him to be, because of the benefit of the Abrahamic covenant. He ought to be in his own land, Palestine, but he's not. He's been taken up there. So God has set the stage by putting Daniel in the Babylonian government. And that's where he's going to then be able to interface with and talk to Nebuchadnezzar and have this revelation that he's going to get here come about. So you kind of understand how the stage has been set. Combination of judgment, nation used by God against nation, and the geopolitics of the day have set the stage for Daniel being in Babylon. Okay? That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, we want to go on here this morning. Now, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, this would be about 603 or 602, because remember, he started reigning in about 606 or 605. So this would be his second year. So Daniel's been there maybe 2 or 3 years. So in Nebuchadnezzar's second year, this gives us the time marker for this vision. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Now this dream was given to Nebuchadnezzar, not to Daniel, not yet, but to Nebuchadnezzar, and it bothered him. There was something about this dream that upset him pretty good, and he wants to know what in the world this dream means. It was a specially impressive dream that he had. So he calls in all of these supposed dream interpreters and these kind of guys that's in his kingdom. He's got four different categories of them, it looks like, here in verse 2. He gave orders to call the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. Who did he not call? He didn't call God, did he? He didn't go to anybody who could actually tell him this dream. He's got these different categories of, they're probably all a bunch of charlatan types that supposedly can interpret dreams and do this kind of stuff for the king. He gets them all together, all four categories of them here, and wants to know what in the world this dream is all about. So he tells them, says, hey, verse 3, I had a dream and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. So the Chaldeans, one of these four groups, spoke to the king in Aramaic. By the way, we're changing from Hebrew to Aramaic here now all of a sudden, and we'll stay in Aramaic from here through chapter 7 and verse 28. Why is that? Because that period of time is going to deal with Gentile nations, and Aramaic is a Gentile language, not a Jewish language. So this vision is coming to him in a Gentile language appropriate for the content of it. And so one of them speaks up in Aramaic and says, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants and we'll declare the interpretation. Hey, tell us what you dreamed and we will know for sure what it means. Or we'll at least make something up and blow some smoke back at you and you won't know the difference. That's probably the way they work most of the time. And he knows that, I think. Because he says to them in verse 5, Hoth, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me both the dream and its interpretation, in other words, you got to know the dream as well as making up some story to go along with it, and I'll use a little negative incentive here to get you to do this, you'll be torn limb from limb, your houses will be made a rubbish heap. So if you can't come up with this dream I had, you are toast, and everything you own and your families and everything else. But then I'll also use a little positive incentive. If you do declare the dream and its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts and a reward of great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. So you see the stage? He has a dream. He wants his guys to tell him both the dream and what it means. That way they can't tap dance around him and just give him anything they can make up to explain the dream that he tells them about. They got to tell him about the dream. The guy is not an idiot, like they apparently have been treating him like. So they answered him a second time. So, well, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation. So they say again, well, tell us the dream, and we'll make something up to go along with it. And he says, hey, I know for certain that you're bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm. Says, I see what you guys are doing here. You're just trying to buy time because you don't know what the heck you're talking about. If you don't make the dream known to me, there's only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation. So he's saying, you've got to prove to me that you're not just making something up by telling me the dream first. Now, he acts like he's sort of forgotten the dream. I don't know if he really has forgotten it at all or if he's just acting like that to make them tell him the dream as well. He apparently knows enough of it that he'll know if they're on the right track or not. And they're just trying to come up with some way they can save their own necks. So the Chaldeans answered and said to the king, verse 10, there's not a man on earth who could declare the matter to the king. Inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean, what the heck have these guys claimed to be doing all the years that they've been working for Nebuchadnezzar? If they can't do this, what can they do? Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult. Hey, you're asking us to do something hard. That ain't fair. And there's no one who could declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. More of an excuse probably than it is a statement of their theology. Gods is with a small g there, of course. And because of this, then the king became very indignant. This was not the right answer to give him. To basically say to him, hey, you're an unreasonable jerk for asking us to interpret your dream, to give you the dream and its interpretation. Nobody can do that kind of thing. And he is very indignant and furious, verse 12. And he gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Now, apparently, that wise men is apparently a general category of these four specifics that are listed here. All of these guys in the kingdom that are claiming to be able to do this kind of thing, they get a paycheck every month claiming to be able to do this kind of thing. He knows that they cannot. So he says, why in the world would I want to keep you around? So he issues this command to destroy them. By the way, there's an interesting little sidelight here. It may have nothing to do with anything, verse 12. This category of people with this sort of interest are called wise men here. What do we call the magi at Christmas time? They're usually called the wise men too, aren't they? Now, I wonder if the lore of the coming of a Jewish Messiah, a Jewish king, I wonder if that was planted down there by Daniel when he was there in Babylon 600 years beforehand. That's a long, long time, isn't it? But if that got established in their lore, in their history, this category of people might have retained that down through the years, and the guys that we call the wise men may have known something about that from Daniel in his stay down in Babylon. I don't have any idea if that's true or not. It's just a thought. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But at any rate, that being set aside, the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. So Daniel and his three buds are in that general category of wise men, interpreters of dreams and that sort of thing. So they're trying to round him up and the other guys and put them in this big pot of all of these guys and kill them all. So all of a sudden, what looked like a providential care of Daniel by God in putting him in the Babylonian government in a role that associates him with these guys, that ain't looking so great all of a sudden, is it? Wow. What we thought was a great deal has turned out to be blow up in your face type of deal. I wonder if it will remain that way. So Daniel replied with discretion and discernment. We've seen this trait in him already, haven't we? He went there probably as about a 17 or an 18-year-old. And we saw him commit his life to obedience to God's laws and God's rules, even if it cost him dearly. That program that he was put in, he could have been tossed if he had not eaten from the king's table and ended up looking worse than the other guys. You know, chapter 1, we went through all that detail. But we've seen this kind of character in him before. This is a very wise and discerning young man. He's remarkable in that regard. I was a young man once. I couldn't tell you which way was up. But this guy, he is sharp as a tack. He's spiritually insightful. He is a very, very impressive young man. And so he replies with discretion and discernment to Arioch, captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. So Daniel tells the guy ahead of him, over this group of guys, and ask him, he said, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? So then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So when Daniel hears what's going on here, he says, wait, what's going on, Arioch? Why is he responding so harshly in this matter? And there's a New Testament principle I want to just remind you of here that kind of applies in this particular case. It's in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. It says, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from testings to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. God knows how to manage our lives and to protect us and to care for us under difficult circumstances, while at the same time keeping the unrighteous under the sphere of judgment. And that's what he's doing here with Daniel. It's not a New Testament. It's a New Testament principle, but it's applied in the Old Testament era to this guy, to Daniel. So Daniel goes in and asks the king that he would give him the time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. Now, does Daniel know the interpretation yet? No, he don't know it yet. But he's gone in to Nebuchadnezzar and said, give me a little time and I'll tell you this dream and its interpretation. That's a pretty faithful move on Daniel's part, isn't it? He has confidence that God will give him this insight. And apparently Nebuchadnezzar does, and you know, he buys a little time for the group there. So what does Daniel do in receipt of this little bit of space from Nebuchadnezzar? He goes to his house, informs his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter. Those are the three Jewish names of his friends. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the Babylonian names. It's the same three guys. So he goes and grabs his friends and says, hey, we need to hit our knees here and have a prayer meeting in order that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. So Daniel gets his buds together, and they go and beseech the Lord for compassion to understand what in the world this dream is about. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So now Daniel does know what the dream was about. God gave it to him, to Daniel, revealed it to Daniel in a night vision. And he probably had a little trouble getting to sleep before he was in this state where he could get a night vision, until he got the revelation from God. So then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel praised God. Always a appropriate response to answered prayer, isn't it? And he points out and cites some of the characteristics of God here that relate particularly to this matter. Daniel answered and said, well, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him, and it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. That is, God is sovereign over the affairs of men. This will be illustrated more clearly in another couple of chapters. We'll see that later. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power. For now thou hast made known to me what is requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. So it is appropriate, of course, that Daniel and his friends would thank God and praise God for their answered prayer in this very short order of time here. So Daniel now knows this vision, and he knows the interpretation of it because God has given it to him. Remember, we saw back here in verse 17, Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. So he's equipped to do this so that when God nudges this thing to him, he's ready to handle it, and he knows what he's going to talk about here. So the first vision given to Nebuchadnezzar has now been revealed to Daniel, and they are a handshake apart, so he can talk to the king about this. So therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, this guy who's over him, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Now again, we see Daniel's character at work here, don't we? He didn't have to intervene on behalf of these other guys, did he? He could have said to Arioch, hey, I got the answer. Get rid of those other bums. They're good for nothing anyway. and I'll take care of this thing for you. But he doesn't do that. He lobbies on behalf of the other guys in this category of wise men that they be spared as well. He's a decent, compassionate, caring individual, in addition to having the discretion and justice we've seen already. So, Antioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles of Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. A little human nature being as it is there, Arioch tries to take credit for finding Daniel. Arioch goes into the king and says, hey, I got the solution here. I found this guy. I rooted him out and I got the information that you need. He didn't do any of that. Daniel found him, remember? But this is human nature at work. Take credit for somebody else's blessing if you can. So the king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, that would be his Babylonian name, instead of Daniel, his Hebrew name. He says, can you make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. That is, nobody can do this on their own natural power and ability. But however, there is a God of heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what will take place in the latter days. This was the dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. What he has defined to you, Nebuchadnezzar, are events that are going to take place in a period of time called the latter days. And we'll see what that is as this thing unfolds here in just a moment. So Daniel says, look, no man can do this, but God can do it, and he's made it known to me, and I will make it known to you. So he gives the credit where the credit is due. And proceeds on with then this interpretation rather than trying to take credit for it himself. We'll take it in this order. So what he reveals, and you've got a copy of this in your handout, he says, but as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than any other living man, but the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king that you have they understand the thoughts of your mind. So Daniel points out, look, God revealed this to me, and I'm going to reveal it to you. And so here's the vision, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. Verse 31. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. This was a very impressive statue, however it is figurative. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Now here's what he's describing to Nebuchadnezzar. This statue, that's an impressive statue, isn't it? If that looks like a goofy sketch, it's because I drew it with a mouse. You ever try to draw curved lines with a mouse? If you think it's easy, try it sometime. It isn't easy. That's the only software I had about 40 years ago when I first drew this. So I drew it with a mouse, and it almost comes together at places. But the point of this is, regardless of how stupid it looks, is that this statue was segmented into four different segments. Each segment is a different metal. At the top is gold, the torso is silver, the belly and thigh is bronze, and the bottom part of it is iron and clay. Now, clearly, as you go down the height of the statue, the metal becomes less and less valuable. So whatever it represents, it appears to be declining in inherent value as you come down the height of the statue. That's the dream, okay? This magnificent, as you can see, statue segmented into four different kinds of metals, decreasing in value as you go down the statue. To where you get down to the very bottom, it isn't even a metal, it's clay. All right? That's the vision. What the heck does it all mean? Well, you continued looking until a stone was cut without hands, and it struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and crushed them. So he's watching this thing and he's looking at it, and all of a sudden, here comes this stone that was not cut out of stone by men. It was not hewn by men like you normally would have. It smashes on the feet of that statue and the whole thing collapses. Then the iron and the clay and the bronze and the silver and the gold were all crushed at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found, but the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Stones or mountains are oftentimes representative of kingdoms, just FYI, and we'll see that in just a minute. Okay, so let's review the vision. A statue segmented into four different segments, each represented by a precious metal that decreases in value as you come down the statue. And he's looking at this, and this stone comes from nowhere and smashes this thing on its feet down at the bottom, which is part iron and part clay, and the whole statue collapses and turns to dust and is blown away, and the stone that smashed it becomes a great mountain. Got the picture? What the heck is that all about? This was the dream. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. All right, here's what all of that means, Daniel says. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. You're segment number one. You are sovereign over the earth. You are the world empire that dominates the entirety of the earth at this time. You are the head of this statue in this vision, O Nebuchadnezzar. Oh. The head is Nebuchadnezzar. And as soon as I find my place, we'll go on. Where was I at? 39. Okay, yeah, verse 38. Yeah, verse 38, you are the head of gold. Okay, now verse 39. After you, there will be another kingdom inferior to you. That's why the second kingdom is represented by silver and not gold. It is an inferior kingdom to his. Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. And there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these things into pieces. So these four segments represent four different kingdoms. Each one will be inferior to the previous one as represented by the decreasing value of the metal. The last one is made of iron, and we'll see in a moment mixed with clay. But you can take an iron bar and you can pound that head of gold into about any shape you want to, or the torso of silver, and same thing with the bronze. That iron will bust up and break and smash all of the previous ones if you want to use it that way. It's inferior in value, but it's stronger in strength. So four segments, four kingdoms. The first one is Nebuchadnezzar, and after him will be three more kingdoms represented by these metals. And in it, verse 441, and in it you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. That is, the mixture of the bottom segment is a combination of things that don't really adhere to one another, do they? Iron and clay. So that it is a mixture, but it isn't like coherent or pure in any way. It will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. It is not all that united, but it is very, very strong. And the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery. So some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. So the bottom kingdom, the fourth one, will be strong but brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. So it will be some sort of a confederation, some sort of a uniting together, but it won't be very strong. And in the days of those kings, the ones involving this fourth segment, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people, but it will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it itself will endure forever. So during the time of this fourth kingdom, God will establish a kingdom himself. The stone that hit that statue on its feet back there and crushed all of that will be replaced by a kingdom that God sets up. Not men. And that kingdom will endure forever. So inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountains without hands, and it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great king has made known to the king that what will take place in the future, so that the dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Now, what he has described there are four world kingdoms, and history has given us the answer of who they are as we've gone down through time. The first one up there is Nebuchadnezzar. He ruled for about 70 years. Remember, Jeremiah told these guys that when God judged them, they were going to be held in Babylonian captivity for 70 years, and then God would judge them. So Babylonian Empire lasted for 70 years. Then they were taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire from about 538, 539 down to about 325 BC, when the Greeks followed them and came in and took them over under Alexander. And then ultimately the Romans came along and took over the Greek Empire either around 65 BC, or sometimes people use a little later date, isn't critical. So that the four segments represent those four world empires, and history has shown us that they did indeed follow one another, just as he said, and each one of them was more inferior than the first one in certain respects. And those four kingdoms have dominated the Jews from that time forward, from the time of Nebuchadnezzar in 605 BC, down to the time in which God will establish his own kingdom here on earth, which lasts forever. That's at the second advent. So the timing of this vision goes from Nebuchadnezzar's day in 605 BC down to the second advent. So it's from here, when the vision was given, down to here, when Christ will come and establish his millennial kingdom here on earth. So it's over 2,600 years of history, at least, from Nebuchadnezzar's day down to Christ's day at the second advent. Not the first, but the second. So that time period is called the times of the Gentiles or the latter days, either one, is the time period during which Gentile nations will dominate and rule over the Jewish nation. So that vision just gave you 2,600 years of prophetic history of Gentile nations from 605 BC down to the Second Advent. And we can't put a date on that because we don't know what that is. Okay. Now there's more to all of this that we haven't seen yet. We'll have to come back here in just a little bit. But what we think is going to happen, I'll go ahead and tell you ahead of time, is that following these four, and the interesting thing about the fourth one is the Roman Empire, it was never actually defeated and absorbed by another nation like the previous empires were. The Medo-Persians took over all of Babylon. The Greeks took over all of the Medo-Persian Empire. The Romans took over all of the Greek Empire. But nobody ever took over all of the Roman Empire. It just kind of started fracturing and falling apart. And I think historians use something like 457 or something like that as a final date of it. But nobody ever actually absorbed the Roman Empire. It just kind of broke around in pieces and has been sort of laying around ever since. And what we'll see as we go forward is that that final form, that fourth empire, will come back to life in the form of a 10-nation federation of some kind. That's why the toes, or 10 toes, are represented there in the fourth segment. And it will be at that time that Christ will come back and crush all of those previous empires. They're all kind of absorbed in the previous one, so Rome really represents all of them, and reorganized Rome will represent all of them. And that's when that Messianic kingdom will be established. So this vision covers that time frame, and the most important takeaway probably from this whole thing is that the fourth empire has not yet actually ever gone completely away. It's going to come back. And we'll see more of that as we go along. You get the picture? Four world empires: Babylonia, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And Rome just kind of hibernates for a long time, and it's going to come back to life. We'll see how long that will be a little later on in the book. So I'm giving you some information here ahead of time I haven't shown you yet, but I will show you before we're through. It's going to be a 7-year period of time. We'll see that right in chapter 9. And so that will then take place, and it will be that last form that will be in place when the Lord returns. This form right here will be in place when the Lord comes back at the Second Advent and crushes all of these by virtue of crushing this one, which will be their representative at the time. And we know this time period here. We'll get to it later for sure. I'll show you later, but it's going to be a 7-year period of time known as the tribulation period. But we'll see all of that. So this vision in chapter 2 is extremely sweeping. It tells you what all Gentile nations will be doing for the next 2,600 years after this vision is given. And they will dominate Israel that whole time. That's why it's called the times of the Gentiles. Jews will not be a prominent, dominant nation until the Second Advent right there. Doesn't mean he won't be a nation, they just won't be a dominant one. The Gentiles will dominate them. So you got the picture? We're going to see the same vision repeated two more times and embellished slightly differently each time, but it will be the same basic picture. four world empires, the last one of which will sort of come back to life, still in the future. See, most of that's in the past, and everything is in the past here, from here down to here. And this part isn't yet. It hasn't happened yet. But these empires have come and gone, with this one kind of staying alive and coming back to life here. So what's Nebuchadnezzar's response to this? He fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present him an offering and fragrant incense. He's impressed. He's a happy camper. And Daniel answered in verse 47, or King answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Now, it would be nice if Nebuchadnezzar has come to a point of belief in Daniel's God, but it's a little hard to tell exactly what his thinking is here. He may just be sort of comparing Daniel's God to his gods and saying, "Hey, Daniel, yours is better than mine. I didn't get the answer, but you did, so yours is better than mine." But he may not really understand all that much. We can't say as much as we might like here, but clearly he recognizes the superiority of Daniel's God to his, because Daniel got the answer and he couldn't get it. So then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. So now Daniel's kind of, he's doing a Joseph imitation here. He's moved up to kind of second in command in the whole of Babylon as a result of this. He's certainly over this whole class of wise men. And so Daniel makes requests to the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. So Daniel asks Nebuchadnezzar to give his friends positions, and he does, and Daniel stays in the court in Babylon, and these guys are out in the kingdom running the whole thing. So it all worked out providentially great for them, didn't it? Now, we're going to hang more meat on this before we're done. This is just kind of the first look at this thing from the standpoint of this broad brush history of Gentile nations. So that we are looking for, at this point in our lives, some sort of a resurrection, some sort of a coming back to life of this fourth world empire represented by the 10 toes of that statue. What form might it take? A military alliance? An economic alliance? A political alliance? I don't know. But it will include, we know from whence it will come and what it will include. It will include these countries here. Can you see that red border? I tell you what, I got another one that makes it maybe easier to see. This is a picture of the old Roman Empire. And you can see that one, can't you? The old Roman Empire was essentially, or the Mediterranean Lake was a Roman lake, Mediterranean Sea. That's the old empire that's going to come back to life. Not necessarily every nation in there, not geographically every point inside the red line, but from within that red boundary is where this final 10-nation federation will come. They're the 10 toes of that statue. So those nations there will be the ones that form this last world empire, this last Gentile world empire that Christ will crush at the second advent. And we don't know what nations it will be, but from that group right there will come the final form, that was in that vision that Daniel just had, the 10 toes. Got the picture? Anything going on there now? You seeing any kind of a 10-nation federation coming together over there now? You're seeing better than I am if you are, because I don't see it. And we got the European Common Market. That's not 10 nations. That's about 25 of them. That doesn't look like that's it for sure. It may be some phase of that, some form of that. You got NATO, which is a military alliance, and some of these nations are in it, some more in it than others. Germany barely in it at all. Others a little more committed to that military alliance. Let me propose a scenario for you. Iran gets to where they can enrich uranium to the level that they can make a nuclear weapon out of it. What's Israel going to do? Sit back and watch that? No, they're going to go over there and bomb the heck out of that place when they think that Iran is getting too close to being able to do that. What's Iran going to do? Well, they're going to start throwing missiles at Israel with everything they got through their proxies over there, the Hezbollah and those guys up in Lebanon, all over the place. And their missile technology is a lot better than it used to be. And they got a lot more of them. Mostly what they've done in the past is just throw missiles up in the air and hope they hit something. The guidance system and everything's no good. But what they've got now, I think, is much, much better. And they're going to be able to pound Israel much more hurtfully than they have been able to in the past with this new missile technology they got. And also, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to cut off their oil flow into Europe. So now you're going to find a European nation, you're going to find a bunch of those people, and it's a cold winter, and they can't get heating oil or fuel from Iran because Iran's fighting Israel, and oh no, we got to get this thing stopped. We got to come together with some kind of an alliance to stop this conflict between Israel and Iran, or we can't get our oil anymore. So let's get together and form something. And so 10 of them get together and they form some kind of an alliance that solves that problem. And they sign a treaty with Israel, which marks the beginning of the tribulation period. And that treaty supposedly protects Israel, since the United States ain't a player anymore. We're gone some reason or another. We'll talk more about that later. But 10 nations could come together overnight to try to solve that problem and to get that oil flowing again into Europe. Europe gets, Germany gets 50% of their oil from Russia. So if Russia, which is sort of an ally to Iran, and Iran both cut off oil flow into Europe, they will find a solution to that somehow, and 10 of them come together and come up with this supposed protectorate treaty for Israel and Iran. That can happen overnight, can't it? So the fact that you can't see it today doesn't mean a whole lot, because it can happen very, very quickly under those kind of circumstances. So it may be a formation of some kind of a military / economic union of some kind that supposedly solves the problem between Israel and Iran. And it is from that 10-nation federation you will have the Antichrist arrive, and that will be your final world empire that's forecasted in that vision there in Daniel chapter 2. Something along those lines will probably, you know, be what happens. I don't know exactly, but something like that. So the fact that you can't see it today is no big deal. It can happen very, very quick. We may be out of here at the rapture before that ever happens, so we may never see it. But some point in time, it will happen. And it will be a fulfillment of that Daniel chapter 2 vision that we just saw. Now, there's a lot more to this story. This is just the first pass of this. We're going to hang a bunch more meat on it before we're done. We're going to get a lot more detail about the nations involved and who the key players are in this final Ten Nation Federation and all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot more to come. This is by no means the final answer. It's the first pass at the general summation of what's going to take place among those Gentile nations. You cool with all of this? Chapter 7 and chapter 8 will be a sort of a repeat of this. We'll get into that later. So do you see and understand now this general broad brush summation of the latter days of Daniel chapter 2, or the times of the Gentiles, whichever you prefer? It's the same basic time period. Four world empires, the fourth of which never really goes away. It kind of goes dormant for a while and then comes back to life during the 70th week of Daniel's 70-week prophecy. We call it the tribulation period. We won't be here.
Thank the Lord.
That's right. And when you get done seeing what it's all about in Revelation 6 through 19, you will be very, 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 very glad that you won't be here.
That's right.
So that's the start of our little journey here, our little excursion into eschatology, is Daniel chapter 2 and this very broad brush, 2,600-year-plus history of Gentile world empires. We'll get to Israel's prophetic history in a little bit. Questions, comments? Yeah, Jerry.
With the beginning of the Roman Empire, were the Caesars the beginning of that?
Yes.
Caesar Augustus?
Yeah.
And
most people label that about 65 B.C. with Julius as the actual beginning of the Roman Empire. And they put the termination date at about 457-ish, a little over 500-year history, but it never really... I mean, the Huns and the Visigoths and all those other guys came in and just chipped away at it. And it started breaking in into the little empires, and it never really was captured by anybody else. And it's been... people have tried to put it back together over the years and haven't been able to. And so it is the most important of those four empires. It's got the most intriguing prophetic history of all of them, because it's going to come back around again.
Well, so much of the United States history was based on Rome. Our architecture, a lot of our government. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more as we go along. The big question for us is, well, what role does the United States play in all of this? And it looks like it's something close to nothing.
That's right. Well, we're already...
we don't play much of anything.
But we do see government leaders leaning toward Palestine and not Israel.
That's right.
Now, there are some things that we can look for. For example, we're going to look at the Olivet Discourse later on, and in that Olivet Discourse, the Lord told his disciples, nobody will like you during the tribulation period. You will be hated by all nations. You won't have an ally. So our relationship to Israel is going to change. We're an ally today, sort of. But that's eroding away in a hurry. Anti-Semitism will grow in this country. How much before we're out of here? Who can say? But we know that will take place. So there's really no role that we see for the United States hardly at all in all of this. But we're jumping way ahead into stuff. We'll walk our way through all of this detail as we get there. But that's kind of the bottom line on it is they will not be able to turn to us for anything. That's why that 10-nation federation will play a role. Israel will trust them to protect them economically and militarily, not us, because we will not be a player on the world stage by then. Or so it appears. The whole Western Hemisphere doesn't appear to have a role. But there ain't nothing in the whole Western Hemisphere besides us anyway to amount to anything. There's no military might, there's no diplomatic might, there's no economic might. There's nothing in the Western Hemisphere to amount to a hill of beans other than the United States. So if we're not a player, you basically can say, well, the whole Western Hemisphere is not a player. That's why that 10-nation European Union type thingy, whatever it is, will be the star player, not us. We're going away. And you can see it happening before your very eyes. Even our military now is starting to pursue this wokeness nonsense. They're more interested in diversity and inclusion than they are fighting wars. How good are we going to be? Anyway, again, we're jumping ahead. We'll cover all of that before we're done. I'll give you a bunch of reasons to understand what I'm suggesting to you is a good possibility before we're done, but we'll get there as we go along. Anything else this morning? Yeah, Betty.
Any word on Bessie?
I beg your pardon?
Is there any word on Bessie?
The last I heard of Bessie, she's trying to get an appointment with a neuro-ophthalmologist. Her eye is giving her problems. She's seeing double. And they think there's nothing wrong with her eye, so they think maybe she's got a neurological problem with their optic nerve or with the eye. And she's waiting to get in to see some guy. Last I talked to her Sunday, and she hadn't gotten an appointment yet. So I don't know, but we'll give you an update on her when we get anything. But it's a vision problem. Okay, you're on OT, so I better let you go. We'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing.